Daniel, first I'll just say a massive thank you for doing the interview with me today.
It's my pleasure, always.
I'm going to ask, what first got you into music?
Oh, first got me into music. You know, I guess I'd have to say my mom. You know, my mom was a wonderful piano player. And when we were little kids, she would play all the time. We had a small den, and she had a piano in there. And she would play and sing, and I just became fascinated with chord progressions and intervals and all sorts of different notes. And I used to spin, she used to put, you know, David Bowie records on and Fleetwood Mac records on and Beatles records on. And that was back in the day when we actually listened to records. So I'm dating myself already, but so I would listen to those records, and I would try to find out how to figure out how to play the melodies on the piano. And that's kind of, I think I just kind of got hooked like that. My mom was really the biggest proponent of my beginnings in music. Yeah, I think so.
When you were younger, who did you used to listen to?
Oh, you know, whoever my parents had on vinyl, you know, Fleetwood Mac and David Bowie, Billy Joel, Elton John, Beatles. My mom was really... She was a very symphonic. She played for, you know, she was like a concert pianist. So she played a lot of classical music. So I also grew up listening to operas and you know, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, Bartok. You know, so the house was always just filled with music. I mean, I can remember her playing like La Boheme or Madame Butterfly, whatever it was, whatever opera, and it was literally at deafening tone volumes of, you know, so it would wake us up in the morning, she would have it cranked all day. So I guess I just listened to whatever they had. You know, I would just go through their record collection and find great music. You know, I mean, I was really lucky because I was exposed to great music when I was a kid. You know, I'm very lucky to growing up when I did, you know, 70s and early 80s, and, you know, discovered Motown and all sorts of stuff that was just such fabulous music, you know, and, you know, Elton John and people that were my heroes that I still listen to this day, you know. It was a great time for music, and it was a great time for me to be exposed to that kind of music. I'm glad I didn't grow up now.
Oh, cheers.
I'm glad I wasn't exposed to the stuff that my kids get exposed to. So I'm really lucky. You know, it's real music, you know, they're real. Like, they had bridges and they had verses and they had these hooky choruses, and they didn't use a lot of, you know, a lot of production to make great music, you know, like Queen and all these phenomenal bands that were coming out that were just doing it based on their talents alone. And it was kind of like a day when not everybody could do it, you know. Now it's like, it feels like anybody can just make a record. You know, but back then, the cream was rising to the top, and it was like, that's what you got to be. Your heroes became those people, and they were really talented. And so I was lucky, you know, I was really lucky.
Okay, so what was it like when you actually first started making your own music? How was that for you?
You know, I was god-awful at it. You know what I mean? I really just wrote these incredibly terrible songs. Actually, to my, you know, still do. I still do write a lot of terrible songs. And but back then it was just, I think I was just trying to figure out a way of communicating. I had a hard time in school, like so many of us do. You know, kind of didn't really fit in. I felt like I was kind of like an outsider a little bit. And I wanted to find something that was going to kind of get me through, you know, my childhood and my high school years. And I started writing songs just because I think it made me feel so good. You know what I mean? It made me feel like I was able to connect with people, even though I don't think very many people heard the songs, but I started developing that way because I think it was just my environment really pushed me into that corner. You know, everybody wants to sort of have something that can make them feel like a connected or something about them that's kind of special. I think writing songs is just a way for me to, you know, sort of get through the difficult years. And they were difficult. You know, I just wasn't really one of those kids that fit in. You know, I used to take a violin to school, you know, so people would sort of mark me right away. You know, I mean, guy's got a violin, for God's sake, walking across the playground, you know. So it didn't take long before I was kind of ostracized and made fun of. And as I got older, I started just kind of continuing to sort of isolate a bit more from, you know, the popular kids. And music was really one of the things that kind of kept me grounded and kept me going and getting through things. So, yeah.
Okay, so when you did first start releasing music, you had your first EP out in 2000. And mm-hmm. So how did that feel to finally get your own music out there for people to hear?
I think, you know, it's really funny. I think, you know, are you speaking of a Canadian release? Are you speaking of the first record? Which record are you speaking of?
The I'm Your Betty one.
Yeah. That was a funny record. You know, I was making that, and I made that in my home small town in British Columbia, and I put that record out, and it was like, it was terrible. Like, it was just one of those things where I thought I was just this, you know, trying to be this over the top, like working with somebody who really didn't understand, you know, how to get a great drum sound or anything, and spending day and day and just trying to push this thing through. And it was really at the end of that album that I actually sort of literally disowned that whole experience. By the time the record came out, it came out on some kind of Canadian release distribution company. And as it was being released, I met the producer who ended up making the first record with me, which the most successful record, which was the Bad Day record. And as I was finally starting to experience this, like, newfound, like, I don't know, like, avenue of music, which was, all of a sudden everything was becoming more easier, and he was able to help, like, shape me and get me to sing and do things that I'd never done before in music. And so as the promotion run came for this I'm Your Betty record, I literally was like, I'm not doing any of it, you know? Divorced that experience and was moving on into this other experience. So I didn't really even pay attention to that record. As a matter of fact, I think once the Bad Day record came out, I was quickly trying to buy up all the copies of albums to get them off the shelf, because it was terrible. I mean, they were the worst songs you've ever heard in your life. And I didn't realize how bad they were until I started moving forward with this new experience. And so I think we literally bought most of the records back as much as possible, so, and stopped the distribution chain from releasing this terrible thing. You know how it goes. So it was my first record that was just, I think it was more of a learning experience than anything, but if I could help it, I didn't want anybody to hear those songs. So, and I think I've seen that record, like, I think one time I was on the internet, somebody shared with it. It was like, somebody was selling it for like $150, and I was like, why would anybody pay money to hear that thing? Anyway, shows you what I know, right?
Okay, all right. Well, okay, we'll go to Bad Day, because that was the breakout, and that got the attention pretty much from the whole world on you. Right. But okay, I've got to ask, is it true that the song was actually recorded in 2002, so 3 years before it was actually released?
It was, yeah, it was one of those songs that was, yeah, it was funny. We recorded it, most of it, then, and just did it in a small little studio, and you know, mostly in an apartment in Vancouver. And what was happening was that it just was one of these things where I just kind of kept it on the side, and I didn't really think of it as anything that anybody would want to hear. And it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years later, maybe 2 years later, that my management heard it and just flipped out. And I was like, wow, that's just, you know, so it's just one of those songs that just really started somewhere, but didn't it didn't, nobody heard it until it was, you know, they were asking me for more music. I was finally moving forward with a record label. Do you have any other songs? And this one just kind of got played in there. But it's like, not only is that going to be your song, is that the song that's going to be the lead off single? And I thought they were mad. I was, there's no way. This is what I want to put out first. I want to put this song out first. And little did I know, you know? So, yeah, get out of your own way, right? Let someone else make those decisions.
And the song was a big success in the UK over here. It got to number two, but in the US and in your home country of Canada, it went to number one. So what was that like, feeling that that success had come pretty much from your first song?
Yeah. You know, I wish I could say it was this really amazing, phenomenal feeling and experience. I can remember driving down the in LA where I live, and you know, the big radio station here called me and said, this has been the biggest song of the year, what is your reaction? And I had nothing to say, and it was embarrassing because I was live on air, and I didn't mean anything by it, by being like you know, some egomaniac. There was a lot of humility involved with it, but I think I didn't know what to say, because as that was happening, and that record was, we were touring with that record for 2 years, I always felt like I was just kind of in the eye of this hurricane. I mean, everything was happening so quickly that I never had a chance to really, I was moving from country to country. I was doing promo for, you know, 16-hour days in Japan. Like, I remember it rolling there, and I never had a chance to really appreciate what was happening, because it was just, it was maddening. There are times where I didn't remember which country I was in. The work was incredibly difficult. It was an amazing experience, but again, like, you just don't really have a moment to yourself to really start appreciating what's going on. And I think it was probably not until a couple of years after the dust had settled that I started to kind of appreciate what had happened for me. And but during that time, it was chaos all the time. You know, I mean, sleep. I can remember doing three different countries in one. We did one day. We did Italy, Germany, and what was the other one? It was Italy, Germany, and part of France in one day. So that was promo in the morning in Italy, then something in the 4 o'clock in Germany, and then I did a show in France at like 9:30 at night. It was maddening. Just to keep myself upright.
Crazy.
Yeah, so again, I mean, it was a phenomenal experience because just try to appreciate what was happening was almost impossible. You know, I think my main goal was just to get enough sleep. And, but I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was an incredible experience.
Okay, I've got a couple more questions to ask on that song, and one of them was that the music video was actually directed by Mark Webb, who went on to do the Amazing Spider-Man films. But what was it like actually having him as your director?
Oh man, well, not only was he the director, but I mean, he wrote the treatments. You know, he was so talented, that guy. You know, he did one, two, maybe three videos with us, with me, which he did Free Loop, and he did Bad Day, and he did Lie to Me, and he just had such an incredible ability to be able to put what was on film, to film something that the treatment, whatever he was directing, you just working with him, it was like, you just got to get out of the way. You just got to let him do his thing. And I'll tell you, for video directors, there are probably maybe 1% of 1% that can really do that. Because when you read a treatment or you know, like a whatever the treatment would say, it all looks good in the treatment. But when you're actually making it, most of the times, the videos I've seen in experience are horrible. You know, they're not that interesting. There's nothing that phenomenal about them. It's like a band playing, and it's like, and I didn't want that. I wanted to be there, some story behind it. Mark was really amazing at developing and creating a story behind the song. And he made that song, I think, as successful as I did vocally, you know, acoustically. He made it visually that amazing. And And Mark was always meant to move on to bigger things. You could just tell by working with him. You knew he was going to make do feature films, you know, 500 Days of Summer and, you know, the Spider-Man series, because he's just that good. And like I said, I think with the treatment, you can read it all you want, but until you really see it, you don't know if it's going to be very good. And then there's directors like Mark where it doesn't matter what the treatment is, it's going to be amazing. And there's not very many directors in the music business that really are like that, you know, that can really you just can trust it 100% that you know it's going to be great. With Free Loop, he had, you know, piano playing by itself, and there's this little relationship, almost like a Pinocchio relationship with this little boy and his piano that kept playing by itself, and this kid would follow it around, and he just came up with these incredibly brilliant ideas that work in a 2.5 minute or a 3.5 minute song, you know, and that's hard to do, you know. And so yeah, working with Mark was just like, it was easy. I just had to do my part, which was always just once in a while play the piano, you know, and you knew the rest of the video was going to be great. Did some other videos with other directors, and they just were horrendous. you just have to work with these really talented people, but there's not that many around. So yeah, working with Mark was phenomenal. And he made that video. He directed that video. He wrote the treatment for the video of Bad Day, and made that, you know, he made it what it was. I had nothing to do with that. So I was pretty lucky. And I caught him just before he was moving on to feature films again. So my timing was good, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think something like the Bad Day music video, I think, shows a lot of his work that he does now, because it is all very... there's a lot of human stuff in it, because you look at, especially go to the Spider-Man films, you always think just action, people in outfits, everything like that, but it's the human stories I think he's able to convey in the films and in the music videos that I thought made him actually really stand out.
Yeah, absolutely. The relationships he develops, like a, you know, again, like in a 3.5 minute, that's hard to make a story really pop in that very small, you know, amount of time. And, you know, guys like Mark, yeah, you're right. He brings a human aspect out, and he made that relationship between the time, these two people not quite meeting up at the same time. I didn't even understand it. I mean, it was so crazy. I mean, the first few times I watched it, it wasn't until a couple of years later that I saw it, that I said, oh, they're missing each other by 5 minutes. And it was funny because there's a bunch of people from the label, and I think there was, that were watching with me, and they looked at me like, this guy's an idiot. Like, he didn't realize that was going on in the video. I had this moment, this aha moment, where I'm like, oh, I get it. The clock's 5 minutes. Okay, they're missing each other by 5 minutes. Yeah, there you go. Now you know who you're talking to.
Okay, and just one more question on that song. Is it true that Weird Al Yankovic actually wanted to parody the song?
Yeah, he did. And I can tell you, you're the first person that's ever asked me that. And it's funny that you're asking me this, because I was the first artist, according to him, he berated my management with phone calls and just went up one side of them and down the other about how dare I not allow him to... By the way, I think you can do a parody of a song regardless if you have the artist's consent or not. I don't think you need that. I think you can... I don't know. I think that's true. But I guess he likes to have the... Oh, the... You know,
basically the thumbs up.
Yeah, and I said no. He went crazy, and you know, he asked. My manager said he wants to know why, and I said, you know, because music's not a joke to me, you know. And I didn't care. I knew that I probably would have made a pile of money from doing it. And I knew that, you know, it was, you know, Michael Jackson says yes to me, and Madonna says yes to me, and I just was like, but I don't think music should be a joke. Maybe now I'm, you know, being older, and I probably would have not minded so much. But at the time, I just felt like this song meant so much to me. The song was real for me. It was like one of these things that I wrote about. That, but, you know, I made it as light as I could, but it was coming out of a really dark phase for me as I was growing up. You know, I was experimenting. I was having a hell of a time with drug addiction. You know, it was really hard, and I just, when he asked, I kind of was reflecting back on what this song meant, and it was supposed to be this motivational song for people to you know, that shit gets rough and it gets better again, you know, and I didn't want him to make fun of that, you know, and I think maybe if it had been something else, like in a different song, maybe I would have said yes, but I just felt like music is just not a fucking joke to me, and I don't want to make fun of songs, you know, and I think I was the very first person that ever said no to him. I just felt that way, you know. I don't know, like some of the songs that mean the most to me, I can't imagine them being made fun of. You can make fun of it all you want now, but it's just at the time I didn't feel that was necessary. I really didn't know he would react the way he did. I think maybe if I'd realized I'd offended him so much, maybe I would have changed my mind, but at the time, I was actually in the UK. I can remember like that song came in. We were doing the V Festival, and I can remember that phone call because it was a heavy phone call. You know, it was a lot of very angry people involved in that. But I stuck to my guns, and I was like, "I'm gonna make fun of something else." You know, I don't know. Anyway, there you go.
Yeah, he did. He went for Chamillionaires Riding Dirty.
He went what?
Chamillionaire Riding Dirty was the song he then recorded.
Oh.
Which, I've been doing a bit of research.
You've done your research. You know more than me.
The whole album, your self-titled album, was big all around the world, and it charted in many countries. But was there anywhere in particular you were quite surprised to see yourself charting in?
I think maybe part of the African country, like South Africa, was charting, and it was kind of strange for me. I mean, I guess this is, you know, it's a more of a diverse culture there, but I was kind of surprised to see it there. I don't know. It was kind of interesting. I mean, I think the other places were China, which I love to play. I still play there. I was surprised to see it playing. I'm always surprised to see it playing in places that just don't have a lot of experience or influence. There's not a lot of American influence there, you know, and some places just don't have that, and so they don't hear that kind of music, so I was a little bit shocked to see that. That's about it. Everywhere else seems to play the same music, so.
Okay, and I've got to go on to the album that came out after, Under the Radar, which I remember listening to quite a few years ago when it first came out, and I really enjoyed it. It was one of the things that I was looking at the back of it, I was looking at the producer credits, all that, and then I saw that it was actually Linda Perry who produced the album. Yeah. I mean, how did that even come about?
You know, after I took a little bit of a hiatus after the first record, and I guess based on the success of the first record, I kind of had a little bit more of a, to put my foot in the door a little bit more, open a few more doors for me. With different producers, and I just kind of, you know, went around meeting a couple people, and Linda was one of the people that I met, and the first thing I remember, I came to her studio in North Hollywood, and I was sitting in her kitchen, and she walked out, and she had her leather on, and her rings on, and her tattoos everywhere, and she said, look at me, and she said, what the hell do you want? And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, this is the person that I want to work with. You know, a tough woman, you know, incredibly talented songwriter. She said, well, why don't we do this? Why don't you come back and we'll go through a song and we'll see, you know? And I liked that. You know, I liked the fact that she didn't care who I was and the fact that I had become a little bit more established. It was really about whether or not she approved of the songs and she liked the songs. And I kind of felt that was cool, you know, that some of the other people that I had met they didn't listen to any of the music, and they were just like ready to make the record. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to sort of be challenged and pushed, you know. And I knew that Linda could do that. So once she heard the music and she said, yeah, some of these songs are all right. You know, it was great. She kept me in a place of where I kind of liked it. It was a little bit of sort of how I began music. You know, my mom was really hard on me about playing, and she kind of reminded me of that, and she kind of kept me in a place of like where you can do better. I needed that. I wanted to improve, and I wanted to make a better. And I didn't make a record that was nearly as successful as the first record, but I still really love that record. I love the way it sounds. You know, I love how much she worked on her guitar sound and how much she cared about the vibe and the energy of the record. It was such a great. It was an amazing experience. It was hard. I mean, she's not easy on you. And you got to prepare yourself. You got to kind of grow a thick skin to kind of work in a situation like that. But she's also a very beautiful and amazing, talented woman that I grew very fond of, and was willing to sort of do as much as I could to keep it going. But it was an incredible experience for me working with her. And I actually, as much as it was difficult, I still miss her. I miss her very much. I don't see her anymore, but she's still a phenomenal person.
Okay, I've got to ask, because the last album that you had came out in 2012. Right. Have you started planning? Have you got any new music that we should be looking forward to very soon?
Yeah, I think I'm going to start. That record was one of my least favorite records. You know, I definitely felt like I wasn't, you know, on the ball with that. And so what I've done since is, started writing a lot of songs with other writers for other artists, and it came time for me to start a new record. And I've just recently finished the new album, and it is by far to me the best record I've ever made. And I'm really excited for people to hear it. It's actually getting mixed right now, and I'm hoping it comes out late fall or early next year. You know, we're just working on some tour dates right now. I'm actually going over to the East Coast of the United States to play, and then back to China. And then at some point, I'm hoping we can put this record out. But it's, I kind of wish you could hear it, you know, so we could talk about it, because I'm very excited about it. And I did it with an incredibly talented English producer named Warren Hewitt, who you might have heard of. We made it here at a place called Spitfire in Los Angeles, and he was so great to work with. We started with all this stuff, and I brought on all this music with these loops and these little, you know, bells and whistles, and he just looked at me, and he had this phenomenal English accent, which I can't do, and you can do it. And he said, "You don't need any of this stuff, mate. You don't need any of this stuff." I'm like, "What do you mean? I mean, that's how do you..." So it's, this isn't who you are. Take all this shit out of it. Take all these loops. Take all this programming out. And let's just hear your piano. And it's really stripped down. And there's, you know, some pianos and some cellos and there's some drums. But it's like, it sounds like a bunch of guys playing in a room together again. And Warren, you know, I met Jeff Dawson, who did the first record with me and Mitchell Froom. And they made a great record. And Linda made a great record. But I'll tell you, Warren has really made the right record for me, and it's been that record that I've always wanted to make. And I know people say that all the time, but this one for me is like, I'm sure it'll never get played on the radio. I'm sure it'll never, no one will ever hear it, but it was the right record for me.
Oh, I can assure you, it'll definitely be played on my show.
You'll play it. I'll play it. You and I can sit down and we can discuss it and we can analyze it and break it down and you can tell me what you think.
If you come over to the UK, you'd be happily welcome in the studio, and we could do just that.
Oh, really? Okay, I'll hold you to that, mate, and we'll dissect the record, and you can tell me what you like about it. And by all means, please tell me what you don't like about it, because that's always my favorite thing too.
Okay, that's a deal.
All right.
Okay. Right. Couple more questions. Because I'm sure fans have probably given you a huge array of items over the years, but what is the strangest thing that you've ever received from a fan?
Oh, you know, I used to get cake. People would bake cakes and send it in the mail. And one time, and I, you know, as lovely as that was, and as much as I appreciated it, I didn't know whether or not it had arsenic in it, or, you know, whether or not somebody was having, you know, trying to do me in. So I never actually ate the cake. But my assistant was you know, disposing of one of the things that was been sent to my manager's office, which was a cake. And inside that cake were all of these broken watches with glass, broken glass in them. And it was like, I was like, I freaked right out. And I was like, okay, so now I know that literally these cakes are ticking time bombs, right? And so I don't know if the... See, the thing that always confused me about it was the cake was completely immaculate, like when you open the box. So how are the watches broken inside? I mean, and they were all on, and it freaked me out. So that was probably the strangest, creepiest thing I got, you know, with a note that said something like, it's time for you to, and I don't remember what the rest of it was, but it was all just, the cake was in the shape of a clock, and inside were about three or four broken watches with the glass broken. And, that just sent me chills down my spine. So that was probably the strangest thing, you know. Yeah. And you're making me relive it right now. You realize that, right? I'm like, that makes you...
that is, sorry, but yeah, that is pretty bad.
Isn't that creepy? Would you find that a little bit creepy?
I would basically just barricade all my doors and windows and just not go outside for a month.
Well, you know, and here's the funny thing, and this has happened to me too before. I had, you know, there's a camera at the bottom of the gate at the house, and I don't know, it's got no relationship to that, but I've had it where people put something over the camera so you can't see it. And rang the doorbell so that when you look to see at the door, you can't see who they are. So I've gone through some pretty crazy experiences, you know, when people broke in onto the property and it was like, you know, stuff happens, but there are times where you're like, wow, this is a little bit nuts. Like people are taking this stuff a little too seriously. It's just music, people. It's just music, you know, it's supposed to enlighten you and, you know, get you through the day, and it's supposed to, you know, inspire you. It's not supposed to make you send clocks, cakes with broken glass in them. You know, that's not the message that I was trying to send to people. I mean, I would think someone like Marilyn Manson might inspire that kind of thing, but not me. I mean, just this goofy guy that sings light songs, you know? Anyway.
Okay, and... okay, last question, and if you ever got the opportunity to work with anyone in the world of music, so if there was anyone that you absolutely desired to collaborate with, who would you choose and why would you choose that person?
Oh, I don't know. I think maybe for me it would be someone like, are you talking about like a producer? Like
anyone on that side, sir.
I would think someone like Daniel Lanois probably still is my most favorite person as far as record production is concerned. Just the way he makes music, you know, how he can take a living room and turn it into this beautiful place to play, and you know, plays in a circle, and you can have anyone from U2 sitting in that seat to, like, you know, whoever. I mean, and just lets the songs develop on their own and finds the right way of recording them. I've always been fascinated by the process that he makes to make records, and I would love to work with him, but I think he probably charges about $1 million to make a record, so I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but yeah, I think he would probably be my number one choice as far as working with at this point.
Oh, that's a cool choice, and like you said, he has worked with you too. He's worked with Sinead O'Connor, Peter Gabriel, so loads of acts.
Yeah, it's his process then that makes the music sound the way it sounds, and it's always interesting. I always love to listen to like records that are still made, and you can listen to them and you go, I'm pretty sure either Steve Lillywhite or Daniel Lanois or Brian Eno was involved with this record, or whoever your heroes are, you know what I mean? You just hear these little nuances that are really common in each process, in each record, and you can just hear the little bits, and you're like, wow, that's what I want to do. I want to make music like that. You know, have no limit on time and budget, and just sit in a room and make these great records. Unfortunately, the days of that are over, and we have to take the reality of making music in a Pro Tools on a box and getting it done in 10 minutes. So,
Daniel, I'm just going to say, just once again, a massive thank you. It's been really great to chat to you. It's been really great to learn all this stuff about you. It's just been incredible.
Well, I can tell you, it's one of the nicest interviews I've had in a long time. And I really appreciate, you know, you asking great questions and interesting questions. And thank you, because it's nice to listen and it's nice to answer questions like that, you know. And you know, sometimes with the UK press, you never know what you're going to get, right? So it's, I always, it's always refreshing to really talk about great stuff and interesting things like that. So I appreciate you calling.
Oh, no, it's not a problem. And I like to, I would like to think of myself as one of the nice guys. So, yeah, thank you.
You are one of the nice guys. Yeah, and I'll put that, I'm going to take a photo of the email that I have, so I have your information, so I know next time that you're up on the, you know, list of people to talk to, I'll be like, that guy first. So that way I know we're in a good place.
Oh, that's brilliant. I mean, like I said, we'd definitely love to do something once the new album's out. Definitely love to have a chat around that.
Absolutely. So. I'll come to the studio when we're outside of London, and we'll figure it out. We'll sit down and we'll dissect the songs together.
Brilliant.
Thank
Daniel,
you, mate.
All the best. Thank you very much.
You too. Take care of yourself.
Take care. Bye.